Well, when I landed in Berlin, I got a cold, and so I was very worried. But I spent the time in a hotel room writing this up, thinking if I cannot concentrate because of my fever or something, I better have something written up which I can read out. But this morning I realized I'm losing my voice as well. So I'll do my best. So a number of things the Subrata said, I'm tempted to pick up from there. But I think what you'll hear most, hear me most talking about is the fact that the partition was supposed to have created these national spaces, India, Pakistan, and Bangladesh. To what extent are they national spaces? After all, just because we have an idea that these should be all national spaces with national citizens, has it really worked? I must admit I hadn't thought about it myself that way. But it began about a couple of years ago when I was invited by the University of Tokyo. They were interested in the partition entirely from the perspective, believe it or not, of Iraq. They're very worried that in Iraq everybody is talking about partition. And they felt that partitions don't work. Americans were very easily talking about partition of Iraq as if it'll work. And they thought the South Asian partition has a lot of lessons. So which was how the workshop began. And later on, once I began thinking about that, I've been talking about this here and there. Then last year, so you will know that was the 60th anniversary of Indian independence. So a number of Indian feminists are getting quite interested in the partition. And so they actually had a series of lectures called on this subject. And I gave one of those lectures. So I've been thinking quite a bit about partition. And making a connection between the partition and the political crisis in that region. So you can hear my voice so that I'm going to read out and do the best I can. Cross-border migration and citizenship are highly controversial issues in Assam and the rest of Northeast India. For six long years, from 79 to 85, there were sustained protests against the entry and enfranchisement of foreigners. Elections could not be held, and census operations of 1981 had to be cancelled. And those of you who know about these conflicts, census operations being cancelled is interesting. Say, Lebanon hasn't had a census for the last 40 years. So census becomes very political in situations like that. So the census operations being cancelled is not just accidental. Significant ethnic violence occurred during this period. The issue remained unsettled, and since 2005, and especially this year, things have taken a turn to the worse. About a month ago, there was a series of bombings in Guwahati, which were really, even by the standards of this area, it really crossed the threshold. And the bombings, too, are related to this issue. historically, the people of Delta, Eastern Bengal, has been very mobile, being forced to frequently find new settlements as rivers change course. And Delta, Bengal is, of course, contemporary Bangladesh. In the 19th and 20th centuries, worsening economic conditions accelerated emigration. This population movement has extended to next door Assam since early 20th century, initially as part of a deliberate policy of colonization. However, Assam has resisted being treated as a frontier or a land without people. And the frontier category you can really apply to a lot of parts in the world. One group's frontier is another group's homeland. So frontier is sounds very easy, but it doesn't really work out that way, as we know, in many frontier situations. that forced the British administration to make modifications in its policy. Yet the pressure of this population movement only got worse over time. While the economically induced migration of poor Muslim peasants continued, the partition generated a big movement of Hindus. But Indian citizenship laws take little cognizance of that. The legal definition of Indian citizenship rejects the idea that Hindus and Muslims are separate nations. At the same time, many in India believe that Hindus have an implicit right of return. The partition complicated the question of the continued migration of Muslims. In recent years, the rest of India has discovered that many immigrants from Bangladesh are actually Muslim. This coincides with the rise of Hindutva that hasn't helped. So here I would have some of my theoretical reflections, which I wouldn't go very much into, which are more connected to your citizenship project. The political discourse of many post-colonial states presupposes the ideal types of the modern state. However, this presupposition doesn't match ground realities. Many actually existing national spaces, for instance, do not fit the norm of the bounded national territory of citizens. In India, there is what a Japanese scholar Hiroshi Sato calls the fault lines between the normative legal definition of citizenship and the actual exercise of franchise being based on the legitimacy of rudimentary documents rather than on the registration of citizenship. It is these fault lines that have become the epicenter of a veritable political explosion in Assam. I hope you've been able to follow me with my voice. Okay? I'm a little worried now. Despite the destabilization associated with globalization, citizenship remains firmly grounded in the nation. The citizen-foreigner binary is foundational to the contemporary global political imaginary. However, while the common sense nurtured by the national order of things has significant normative power, in practice, things are more ambiguous than they seem. The average citizen's view of the foreigner is not always framed by a hard boundary conscious citizen-foreigner binary. While a hard boundary conscious view may sometimes be the dominant frame, it is still only one among several frames. There's a basic ethical ambiguity inherent in the concept of citizenship. While citizenship is inclusive and universalist in its inward-looking face, its outward-looking face is exclusionary. When well-meaning liberals talk about social citizenship and equal or democratic citizenship, they aspire to making citizenship inclusive, but only for citizens. In its outward-looking face, there is no apology for exclusion. It is citizenship's normative core. On the other hand, the border is not hermetically sealed from citizenship's universalist commitments. Humanitarian rules governing the admission of foreigners and refugees and procedures for deportation are examples. I mean, what I deal with here is the fact that many rights don't really belong to national citizenship, they belong to persons. So for instance, I don't know about German law, in America you could be a resident alien, but you have all rights, you don't vote. But so rights don't always depend on national citizenship, they depend on persons, if you like. So in a way, what I'm trying to do theoretically is rescue citizenship from the nation state. I think we've very far too easily given up on the citizen and nation state. I think it can be claimed back, is my broader goal. Of course, such practices are under serious pressure today. Yet in principle, there is no reason why the traditionally inward-looking universalist commitments of citizenship cannot be extended outwards. Northeast India is a frontier, which is my, now I'm getting into my historical material. British colonial rulers viewed Assam as a sparsely populated frontier region with vast amount of wastelands. The story of Assam tea begins with the allocation of large tracts of wastelands to European planters. But the colonial goal of making productive use of Assam's wastelands also led to a policy of facilitating peasant cultivators from densely populated parts of the subcontinent to settle in Assam. If you look at my handout, you'll see Assam itself changes in terms of its geographies. So the front of it is about what is Indian India, we call Northeast India, within which Assam is a state. And if you look at pages 2 and 3, you would see the changing geography, which becomes important. But I won't dwell on it now in the interest of time, but keep that in mind. The last page of the handout gives some historical dates which will be important. Most of you know all of them, I suppose, because they're really for not necessarily for a South Asian audience, but take a look. Some are more Assam specific dates you may not know, like the discovery of tea, 1823. And so just quickly take a look so that you can follow it. The story of Northeast India's demographic transformation becomes all too apparent from the census data. Immigration rapidly increases population density. However, the data says practically nothing about citizenship status. The migration began before the partition and continued after that. Many are foreigners in the post-partition sense of the term. Every evening at the military border closing ceremony in Wagha, India and Pakistani soldiers ritually enact the mutual hostility between the two countries. I don't know if any of you have seen the ceremony, it's quite a striking ceremony. Through a display of choreographed Punjabi machismo, the ceremony underscores and exaggerates the lines drawn by the partition of 47. One cannot avoid the feeling that Pakistan would have to be invented if it wasn't there already. There's no equivalent of Wagha on India's eastern border. The two borders are not alike. In Punjab, the exchange of population occurred in the immediate aftermath of the partition and this brutal ethnic cleansing that took place before the horrific term was invented. In the East, however, the movement of population remained open-ended. If useful, distinguish two frames of citizenship in post-partition India, the Nehruvian non-discriminatory frame and the Hindu nationalist frame. There's no way in Indian law to make a distinction between Hindu and Muslim arrivals from Pakistan or Bangladesh, except in the context of the immediate post-partition years, and that too only by inference. Both categories of migrants are foreigners, and they can become Indian citizens, but only through a legal process akin to naturalization. However, when it comes to Hindus, as I've indicated, the frame of Indian citizenship laws is not necessarily the most authoritative. The politics of citizenship in Assam has a distinct local accent as well. The majority view among the Assamese is stubbornly non-discriminatory. It doesn't acknowledge an implicit right of return of Hindus. This is not surprising. Assam did not participate in the partition like, say, Punjab or Bengal. There are no Assamese Hindus in the territory that became Pakistan who moved to India because of the partition. To take the extreme view of the separatist organization United Liberation Front of Assam, the Indian political system's acquiescence in the gradual political marginalization of the locals is but a symptom of Assam's subordinate political status in the pan-Indian dispensation. ALFA's political agenda is to restore Assam's sovereignty that it argues it lost in 1826 when Assam became part of British colonial India at the end of the Anglo-Burmese War. So I'm basically distinguishing between different ways of seeing. I'm saying there is the Nehruvian frame that doesn't matter, Hindus and Muslims, they're all citizens, and everything stops in 1950, which is according to the Nehru-Liaquat Pact, and if anybody who comes will have to apply for citizenship, etc. Then I'm saying there's a Hindu nationalist frame, that they really have implicitly, they talk about the right of return. Not a word they use. I'm obviously using it from Israel-Palestine kind of a debate. And then I'm saying there's a local frame, which again didn't even participate in the partition. So, and this clash of these three frames, I'm saying, is producing some of the conflicts. For nearly three decades after independence, the Congress Party ruled government in Assam managed to keep the issue under control. During this time, almost any adult in Assam could get his or her name included in the citizenship, in the electoral roll. Franchise could become an easy a matter of local level political patronage, because what is involved is not a formal certificate of citizenship, but a rudimentary document like a ration card that gave a person access to subsidized food. Based on such a document, anyone could get his or her name included in the electoral roll. This arrangement allowed Assam to postpone indefinitely a resolution of the citizen-foreigner question that is both legal and authoritative. Ironically, it was not a radical local nationalist who upset this apple cart. No less a constitutional authority than India's Chief Election Commissioner spoke in 1978 of the large-scale inclusion of foreign nationals in the electoral rolls. Seemingly unaware of the political firestorm he was about to set off, he warned, the stage would be reached when the state may have to reckon with the foreign nationals, who may in all probability constitute a sizable percentage, if not the majority of the population. It's quite striking coming from the India's Chief Election Commissioner. The words proved to be the lightning rod for the citizenship controversy of 1789-85. Suddenly, as many as 4.5 to 5 million people in Assam, that is 31 to 34% of the population in 71, were said to be foreigners. The campaign mobilized enormous popular support, but its platform made a large segment of multi-ethnic Assam's population extremely anxious. Then I talk about what I call a hybrid citizenship regime that has evolved as a result of this politics. Since then, India has tried to manage this ambiguity about citizenship through an intricate set of legal and political maneuvers. The arrangements devised can be described as a hybrid citizenship regime. It has three elements. Migrants who moved to Assam from East Pakistan, that is migrants from the 47-71 period, were to be deemed Indian citizens. As you saw from the table, 71 is a key year when Bangladesh comes into being. Before that, it was Pakistan, right? So, then number two, a distinction was made between those who arrived before 66 and those who came between January 66 and March 24, 71. The latter were debarred from active citizenship or voting for 10 years. Three, those who came after the formation of Bangladesh, that is post-71 migrants, were given the protection of a judicial process against deportation. The first element, full citizenship for March 71 or pre-March 71 immigrants, is quite straightforward, and one could argue there is nothing hybrid about this category. The second element is clearly hybrid, since it recognizes a category of foreigner as would-be full citizen whose voting rights is suspended for 10 years. The third element, the IMDT law, and in my handout you'll see the last but one category is the IMDT law. I just use the word IMDT, but it's a long name, and that's a very crucial law in 83. And the Supreme Court found it unconstitutional in 2005, which really set forth the contemporary political crisis since then. So you'll hear me about the IMDT law. The IMDT law is most interesting. Its express purpose was to establish tribunals to expel illegal immigrants in a fair manner. However, its function was to insulate post-71 immigrants from Bangladesh from the application of India's ordinary citizenship laws. In the case of disputed citizenship in India as a whole, the burden of proving citizenship status is on the person concerned. The Assam-specific law reverses the burden and spells out an elaborate procedure for registering a complaint about someone being an illegal immigrant. The person making a complaint had to reside within the jurisdiction of the same police station as the person in question. This was a fairly solid protection, since the solidarity is based on local residential and ethnic networks were likely to be indifferent to the legal distinction between citizens and foreigners. I hope you got basically these three elements, and I'm calling them hybrid citizenship regime. The hybrid citizenship regime was a product of a process that can only be called lawmaking by stealth. It's significant that two of the laws creating the hybrid citizenship regime refer to a date probably resonates more in Bangladesh than in India. March 25, 1971 was when Pakistani military crackdown of the liberation struggle in East Pakistan began. It initiated a massive exodus to India. According to a bilateral agreement between India and Bangladesh after Bangladesh became independent, it's called the Indira-Mujib Pact, those who came to India after that date, Bangladesh took responsibility for them. So what is not said is that nobody takes responsibility for people who come before that date. So there's no more Pakistan, right? So technically think about the fact that Bangladesh is a successor state, but the responsibility they take is only about people who come after 71. So essentially, everybody else becomes by default Indian citizens, right? That's why not said it, but you can see that there was the effect. So, but the interesting thing, of course, about all this is that I may quote you the law saying that is the case, but Indian government doesn't publicize the fact, right, that millions of people are given citizenship. But I think, as I said in one of my op-ed articles, they've spent less money advertising that than on malaria campaigns, right? So nobody knows. So the ambiguity exists because nobody knows. But technically, obviously, everybody is a citizen, right? Except for the post-71 people who are supposed to be not citizens, but there too, it gets much more complicated. And then the reason I call it lawmaking by stealth is the IMDT law was passed by the Indian Parliament in 1983. And that parliament, because of the Assam movement and all that, really was very poorly represented in Assam because there was a boycott of the elections. So imagine a very major law being passed, which has enormous effect on this place, but barely, it was a very badly represented parliament from the Assam point of view. So, but whatever the problem of lawmaking by stealth, the hybrid citizenship regime enabled the Congress Party to continue presenting itself as a sole provider of security to minorities and win elections in Assam, even though it has to briefly make room for a new regional party, the Assam Gana Parishad. So everything, all this was going fine. So I have a first period from independence till 83. And 79-85 was this big Assam movement, which really was a controversy over citizenship. Then comes this hybrid citizenship regime. And then comes 2005, when the Supreme Court says this law is unconstitutional. And then 2005 onwards, you have another phase of political instability, which you see till now, which I mentioned the bombings of a few days ago. So when the Supreme Court ruled the IMDT law unconstitutional in 2005, it brought the hybrid citizenship regime to a screeching halt. The ruling went further than what even the law's strongest critics on Assam would have hoped. The IMDT law, said the court, had encouraged massive illegal immigration from Bangladesh to Assam, and it created insurmountable difficulties in detecting foreigners in Assam. The Supreme Court judgment, so it's not a minor, so they gave lots of figures on how, because of this law, you cannot detect illegal immigrants. So hybrid citizenship regime was a political adaptation to the reality of an actually existing transnational space. By transnational, I'm saying that Yes, partition expects all this to be functioning nation states. But reality is a transnational space. It's not really a national space. There are constant movement back and forth. However, there were serious questions of legitimacy given the foundational nature of the citizen-foreigner binary in the global political imaginary and the normative power of the idea that only citizens should vote. This explains the Indian Supreme Court's position. Yet, only a naive legalist would expect a court to magically settle such a profoundly political question that is ultimately about the birth of the Republic itself. So, you can quote the Supreme Court, but so what? And this is really much fundamental an issue for a court to settle. So, since a high constitutional body such as the Supreme Court has spoken in favor of the orthodox, boundary-conscious view of citizenship, like the Election Commission in 79, Assam has once again been on a boil. Unlike the 1980s, the immigrant communities in Assam are much more politically assertive today, and there are strong youth organizations of the Muslims of East Bengali descent community. So in my handout, you'll see this category I use, which I call Muslims of East Bengali descent. In Assam politics, it becomes a very important category, because you can't simply say Muslims, then Assamese Muslims, whose politics is very different from Muslims of East Bengali descent. So the same category wouldn't do, that's why I have this added category there. Street confrontation over vigilante action, our rounding up Bangladeshis, quote-unquote, by anti-immigrant organizations have turned ugly. This was the context of the serial terror bombings of October 30th, 2008. They were unprecedented in scale, intensity, and simultaneity. Even by the standards of a place quite used to political violence, a threshold was crossed. While I would not venture to guess who was responsible, there's little doubt that the unhinging of the hybrid citizenship regime created the political space for this turn of events. So,
I'm at the time.
All right. Okay, I have some concluding thoughts. I'll jump to Jerry.
I'll give you a second.
Okay. many of you must have read Ernest Gellner's Nationalism. Ernest Gellner had famously compared the world after nationalism with Modigliani's paintings, where neat flat surfaces are clearly separated from each other. There's little, if any, ambiguity or overlap. He contrasted it with a riot of diverse points of color in the impressionist canvases of Kokoschka, his metaphor for the world before nations. From places like Assam, one should not expect to hear news of a Kokoschka to Modigliani transformation anytime soon. Probably, we have not heard the last word yet of this transformation. Often the story of border crossings in our times is told in optimistic and celebratory terms with phrases like post-national citizenship. However, for millions of poor people, the consequences of the tensions between a border-conscious national order of things. By national order of things, I simply mean that it is such a part of our global imaginary. So when you ask, talk to each other, we say, where are you from? We expect a national answer. I'm from France, I'm from India. So Olympics is organized around national lines. But clearly, this will appear very absurd 300 years ago. So I'm saying the fact that we take the nation for granted is what I call the national order of things. and it's not only my term, it was, I think, Lisa. I forget her name. So anyway, the readout thing, you can't really give citations, but my article has citation of her work, yeah. for millions of poor people, the consequences of the tension between a border-conscious national order of things and the imperatives of living undocumented transnational lives are hard. For Assam, the foundation of a legitimate political order becomes more elusive each day because of the growing tension between the expectation of a national order of things and the reality of a non-national space. Here I simply mean the expectation that only citizens should vote, and the reality you just don't know is voting, right? And that produces, of course, its own legitimacy problem. There's no way of knowing who among Assam's working poor, people building homes and constructing roads and railway lines, people working in brick kilns, agricultural fields, shops and small business establishments, people pulling rickshaws and peddling vegetables, and child workers in respectable households, as well as in roadside food stalls, or those picking garbage, is a Bangladeshi and who is not. There's no way of saying, really. And all I can do is talk informally to people And I don't think it's really impossible to say these many people are Bangladeshis. It's impossible. How do you? I mean, people is not a documentary regime that everybody carries pieces of paper. So I'm saying it's just impossible to say this in any sense. Election days in Assam are like holidays. Poor people of Muslims of East Bengal descent go through enormous trouble in order to vote, which is profoundly interesting. I observed this in 2004. Trains carry a large number of them living in other parts of India to Assam. In fact, I went to a railway station to see that. Amazing. People you can make out are from this background, Muslims of East Bengal descent. They may be in Delhi, Bombay, they all come back home to vote. It's an extraordinary sight. They travel to vote in villages and towns where they are registered. In Guwahati, Northeast India's commercial hub, there's a noticeable shortage of rickshaws and vegetable peddlers on that day. Many people in these occupations head home to vote. Voting appears to be more important to them than to many of India's upper and middle class citizens. Only the imperative of basic human security can explain why the poorest of South Asia's political subjects are such earnest voters. A rudimentary document providing evidence of the exercise of franchise could probably make the difference between being able to stay in one's slum home or being thrown out. To them, who wins an election matters greatly. It's not surprising that they spend their hard-earned money on travel expenses and even give up their meager earnings of a day or a few days to go and vote. Indians complain about porous borders and thousands of illegal Bangladeshis living in India. Bangladesh argues that there isn't a single illegal Bangladeshi illegal immigrant in India. But it's hard to see how the two countries could ever speak a common language on this issue. It's after all unresolved even inside India. Indian citizenship practices have not been able to negotiate an authoritative line between what the Hindu nationalists will call homecoming and illegal immigration. So I'm basically saying there's something about the law, but law doesn't mean it's authoritative, right? I don't think so that if we make the distinction, I'm saying that there is the law says one thing and people don't quite buy what the law says. So trying to do that legally risks the Indian state's foundational ideology. The relative autonomy of the Assamese frame from these pan-Indian concerns adds a serious layer of complexity to this troubled politics of citizenship. Citizens and foreigners are essentially contested concepts in Assam. So, you know, in political theory we talk about essentially contested concepts, but imagine functioning if citizens and foreigners are essentially contested concepts. And I'm saying there's no way out from accepting that. Nobody knows. So that is only a political decision. Somebody is a citizen, somebody is a foreigner. It's not an obvious, objective reality out there. Citizens and foreigners are essentially contested concepts in Assam. It's not surprising that when law enforcement officials deport a Bangladeshi illegal immigrant, they drop him or her in the no man's land between the two countries. A person is literally thrown out of the country and he or she is at the mercy of two armed groups, the Indian Border Security Force and the Bangladesh Rifles. Another pathetic performance of sovereign power. This mode of forced repatriation is a growing source of irritation in the relation between the two countries. No sovereign country likes to accept a person unilaterally deported by another country. Yet, there's little recognition in India that deportation involves two countries and not one. However, considering global norms, India's sensitivity to its image, and the implications for Hindu-Muslim relations at home, it's hard to imagine India ever deporting thousands of Bangladeshis in the full view of the global media. But citizenship practices cannot be permanently at odds with actual spatial practices and livelihood strategies. Were Bangladesh and India to find a way to talk about cross-border population movement rationally, certain aspects of it could be better managed. For instance, an Indo-Bangladesh protocol on labor movement could take some of the pressure away from the circular migrant who now has to find proxy citizenship papers and vote in order to find security. What I'm referring to here is that simply if you go to the border, it's not clear at all to mind that just because somebody is crossing from Bangladesh to India, he's going to settle. I think it's really part of this huge transnational movement of poor people, going back and forth, working during one season, going back home, right? So someone will assume they're all going to settle itself is false. But if you look at this contradiction, that may poor people need some piece of paper to show I'm okay. They have to vote, not because they love to vote, just to have the security. Right? So there's some vigilante can ask you, are you Bangladeshi? So it's quite a situation. That's not as if they'd love to vote, but they vote because there's no other security. voted, piece of paper saying you voted, becomes the kind of a source of security. And then the paradox is what I'm trying to get at there. But for this, India will have to shed its unilateral illusions. This might be the first step towards building a formal architecture of governance for this de facto transnational space. Given the history of this troubled politics of citizenship, the liberal notion of making everyone a legal citizen will not have much political traction in Assam. But it may be more rewarding to imagine a multi-level and transnational citizenship regime that decouples citizenship from nationality. I wish I could go slowly or my voice was better. I would have elaborated. But essentially, you know, look, when you are in our situation, doesn't mean something is a practical idea. When you put on a policy hat, the issue you confront is, what is policy? Does policy mean just advising the government to do something? The bureaucrats can do it. So I take my job as a policy person to think about ideas, to make the ideas available, right? Otherwise, here's a troubled area. Policy could just simply mean telling the governor how to kill insurgents, right? So that I'm all for unpractical ideas. Because even unpractical ideas have to be made available. People have to think. So I'm not saying this is realistic, but I'm still saying this is one way of thinking. Given the history of troubled politics of citizenship, the liberal notion of making everyone a legal citizen will not have much political traction in Assam. It may be more rewarding to imagine a multi-level and transnational citizenship regime that decouples citizenship from nationality. It would combine voting rights in Bangladesh with full rights of personhood in India. But crafting such a regime would require imagination and contextual sensitivity. A notion of citizenship as a bundle of rights and rights associated with personhood and the workplace being separated from voting rights, at least at the national or provincial levels, provides a possible way out. While some rights could be universal, others could remain tied to nationality. Resident and migratory foreigners could have the former, but not the latter. For recreating a legitimate political order, some version of a transnational multi-level citizenship regime might be Assam's last hope. Thanks, I'll stop here, but I'm sorry, I wish I could, my voice was better, but yeah, I'll stop here and take questions. Sorry, I almost can see how disoriented I am. I thought I'll add some visuals to it. So, the map you have seen before, but this is the border taken in Tripura. One side is India, the village you see in the background is Bangladesh. Here is again, taken on the Indian side, poor people looking for wood on the Bangladesh side. I mean, you know, what kind of border is that? You wonder now, how do you... And here is a village. One side is Bangladesh, one side is India. People talking. Here is a villager first before crossing the border to cultivate. Here is, I thought, I also... Well, I'll show you some visual pictures of the region. So here is driving towards the border. Assam is mostly hills. You drive to this Khasi Hills to reach the border. So this is really our drive. Drive through it. The valley is Bangladesh, the hills are India. That point is Meghalaya, Khasi Hills really, called the Dauki border. Then Assam, even though I didn't talk about it, tea is a central part of the story. So I thought I'll show you some. There's the Bangladesh border. Those of you who know Bengali will see that. It talks about Bangladesh. Welcome to Bangladesh. Yeah, this cartoon tells you a lot. Take a look. I'll take some, spend some time. You'll see the widespread notion that people come here to vote. Here's, I thought I should show some pictures of tea garden, if you're talking about Assam. Tea garden, that's a tea garden, Bangladesh is a tea garden. Here is tea plantation work. Here is a very interesting part of Brahmaputra River's geography. These are called chors, C-H-A-R, which are like temporaries. Brahmaputra is an incredibly braided river, and people settle in these rivers, in these chors, in those islands. So if you live there, they're really not permanently habitable places. You could really live there, floods come, you move on. So it adds further to the complexity of figuring out who is a Bangladeshi. So clearly somebody may have been 50 years ago, And the living in these chores is inherently mobile. Right? The water comes, you move. So that population is part of quote-unquote Bangladesh. Right? So this chores become very important because it's an incredibly mobile people. About 12.5% of the people live there. And what does living there mean? They're not permanently habitable places, really, most of them. Yeah, I think you have the picture of the maps. Okay, so I will stop here. And
thanks very much.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you.
One of the concepts Professor Bhargava has used, and that's going to be crucial for our doctoral curriculum, is essentially contested concepts. Come from Delhi. It says those concepts which are not directly measurable empirically are essentially contested. For example, if you're stopped by the police on the street and you ask for your ausweis, that's one measurement of your identity. If you have it, you're on. If not, you have a problem. And beyond the ausweis could be blood. If you have German blood, this is how it used to be in the old days when things were much simpler, then you're German. These are examples of how political science concepts get politically problematic in course of time. Because to start with, Nehru had in mind the same concepts of citizenship coming all the way down from Westphalia via Marshall, was that of territorial citizenship. You live on a territory, you identify with it's a state, and you are its citizen. Say, nation state. It gives you the legal right to stay and expects you to fight to defend it. And as Hobbes would say, even if you know that the war is going to kill you, you don't have the right, unless it is for conscience, for instance, to refuse to be transcripted for that battle. So that is the criterion of citizenship that Nehru is also using.
Right.
And the way to do it was to have pacts with countries around India to secure the borders so that all within the border would become Indian citizens. This is not the Yatra Pact, and later Shastri Srinivasa Pact, and a similar arrangement with China, and so on. Now, if that worked for substantial parts of India, why did it not work for Kashmir? Why did it not work for the Northeast? Is the comparative question that we have debated norm and dense in the doctoral curriculum? Then comes the excellence cluster, Europe-Asia comparison, which gives us some additional instruments. And here I would say, we get from Europe these discarded clothes of that one old citizenship, one state, one nation, one religion, one language, one law. Europe gives it to us, and we are trying to implement it. In the meantime, Europe has moved on by devising new ways of handling this kind of multi-level citizenship that Professor Bhargava is talking about. Just think of the German invention called the green card, not the American green card. It was made to entice Indians to come here with easy right to work, but not terminal entry into the citizenship pool, unlike the American green card.
Yeah.
Similarly, many of you also have a EU citizenship card, which says, member of the EU and German or French. Again, one nationality with the right to work anywhere within the European Union. So, while India is least brutally trying to implement a concept, in its homeland it has moved on.
Yeah.
It's lectures like this which will help us understand how the goodness of fit is between sort of acquired concepts and indigenous reality, and to what extent new concepts are developing, like hybrid citizenship, or the Indian method now of having the persons of Indian origin card and overseas Indian citizenship. New concepts which are making it possible for India to give some right to residence and to work and to competition for an entry into elite Indian schools to people who are not Indian citizens but of Indian descent. So that In the area of citizenship, there are a lot of new innovative instruments. Are they concepts? Are they sustainable? Are they consistent with the highest legal forum of the country, like the problem that this law has with the Supreme Court? Are issues that should be researched? And that is what we are trying to do within our citizenship project. Ladies and gentlemen, you have had an opportunity to listen to a very provocative lecture. I'll take questions now. The rule is, well, I'll have to recognize you and write down your name so that I can then ask you to state your question. However, if you think you have a supplementary question, you raise your hand and show two fingers, then you get automatic priority. But if you cheat, ask a new question in disguise, well, in the next colloquium, I'll be very severe. The general discussion is now open. Who would like to ask the first question? Dr. Clemens, please.
Yeah, maybe it's also only invited to your remarks. Thanks very much for the presentation, very thought-provoking. And I think the creativity that India showed with regard to this hybrid citizen regimes in the Northeast, it also shows with regard to the Indian diaspora. We have so many different kinds of non-resident Indians, persons of Indian origin, and so on and so on. But of course, the interesting thing for us from the who are involved in the cluster project is what happened to that imported concept when it came to India? Why was it hybridized or indigenized? And so my question, I mean, it's not really a question only to you, but maybe to all of you here, or the question which bothers us in our project is, is there a quintessential expression of citizenship? As we heard now, identity documentation probably in India is not so relevant for to be a citizenship, for being a citizenship. A work permit probably is also not so relevant, but the right to vote, as you mentioned, which even the poor Bangladeshi immigrants take as a something which is really worthwhile traveling through the whole of the country or whatever, seems to be the for me, at least, some sort of a quintessential expression of citizenship. But my questions or remarks with regard to your presentation is, you mentioned this dichotomy of citizenship spaces and non-citizenship spaces with regard to the Bangladeshi immigrants to Assam or to the whole of the Northeast. What about non-citizenship spaces for people from the Northeast in mainland India? Do they exist as well? Probably not legally or legalistically, but in terms of public perception or morally, however you may call it. And in that sense, also referring to the cartoon that you've shown, is citizenship or this kind of hybrid citizenship that you have in the Northeast not also a result of political entrepreneurs trying to instrumentalize this kind of situation that you have there? Because, I mean, they look for a clientele for the upcoming elections whatsoever. So, I mean, a lot of political agency has also been involved in creating this kind of hybrid regime. And the last remark or question is probably with regard to the way out or the policy that you recommend towards the end, because I'm also familiar with the article you published in the PW earlier this year, I think it was earlier this year, about multi-level citizenship. But there you also referred to the kind of citizenships that you are, have a regional citizenship, like you are a citizen of Assam, and at the same time a citizen of India. You mentioned that with regard to Europe, I think it's not it has not realized to the full extent in Europe, but how do you think should be this kind of multi-level citizenship really come into practice?
I think what I do narrow down my talk, I spoke on one aspect of it. I think, as Clarence rightly pointed out, my own multi-level citizenship idea extends much further. What happens in Northeast India is, this really is partly to the point made by Professor Mitra as well, that it is a very particular space in the sense that what goes on here doesn't really work with other parts of India as such. And one way to think about it is the South Asia's last land frontier. Enormous amount of vacant land, right? So as a result, if you look at, for instance, even economic historical data, for about 100 years, from 1870 to 1970, South Asian agriculture, mostly agricultural productivity grows by expansion of land. And the expansion of land happens entirely in the Northeast. Imagine 400 year period. So that people are cultivating land which was not cultivating cultivated earlier, hill land or chore areas. So essentially then we're talking about the South Asia's last frontier. So then here, on the other hand, you really have a whole legacy of colonial rules because of which it is not really like a normal space. So you have these various states. As many of you know, I think, you know because you go there, you need special permission to go to some of the states, right? So that they really don't operate like other parts of India. So that especially, say, Arunachal, then Nagaland, Mizoram, these three states were in the colonial era were called excluded areas. And then Meghalaya was called partially excluded area. So that means even for an Indian citizen, you need pieces of paper to go there. So what has happened, these old rules have now morphed into an affirmative action kind of program, right? Because there are protections of tribal rights, etc., etc. So as a result, you can't really go in there, buy property, whereas they can come and buy property, etc., elsewhere. So the point is that if you look at over time, whatever you are doing in the name of development is dramatically changing population figures. So in a situation where the political balance, if you like, of really giving the local people more political weight in the assemblies, that situation cannot go on forever. You're really creating a differentiated citizenship regime. So my idea was how to make that idea more democratic. So I'm saying that you have to accept that you cannot go on doing it forever. Doesn't mean you have to really open it up and everybody becomes a citizen. That's not going to work. So there I suggest that you can at least incorporate a non-ethnic element into it by saying that the Arunachal Assembly can have a regional citizenship as well, by which so people who live there for a long time can become citizens. After second generation, third generations. So that idea I try to incorporate into that, apart from the transnational one, which I don't get into here. So, as you can see, I'm not having a very good time with my voice. So, here in terms of the multi-level in the sense of Bangladesh and India, clearly it is, nobody will say it's realistic. But on the other hand, just look at this part of it, that is so out of control in terms of politics that the bombings is a good example. At least if you begin to talk about the fact that people moving, some of them are moving not to come and settle. They're simply moving because it is poor people moving there to work and come back. That is just the labor migration. There you don't deal with everything, but once you deal with at least something, there'll be some less strain on the region. But right now it is such an artificial context. Just imagine, just think about the dysfunctional nature of this relationship. India says there are millions of Bangladeshis. Bangladesh says it's zero. It's such a dysfunctional situation. I'm trying to say it'll be a little more functional if you try to have a normal conversation where they can at least say, well, there are some people who are moving for labor. So that only the attempt to make that conversation begin, right? And with that conversation, it's only a first step towards a larger set of issues about transnational citizenship. So I will, yeah.
And it's a bit like between the United States and Mexico. Uh-huh. They have a similar problem,
right,
in terms of illegal immigration. This suggestion you have assumes that Bangladesh has an incentive,
yeah,
to cooperate with India in terms of developing a regime, mm-hmm, that would bring some people back,
right,
as citizens,
right,
and so on. But does Bangladesh have any incentive at all? Isn't it a rather painless way of solving Bangladesh's own problems of deep poverty?
Water is one sentence.
Look, as I said, I really, it's possible. But on the other hand, if you still start with the fact that this can go on forever, you want to take the next step. You want to really, I think, you know, a Bangladeshi foreign minister once said that just the way Bangladesh may be landlocked by India, not as India is landlocked by Bangladesh. Foreign minister's statement, not a minor statement. All I'm saying is that it is in North East India's interest to really have this conversation. right? So my point is also that foreign policy, typically, we don't think foreign policy is made from Northeast India, foreign policy is made from Delhi. We take it for granted. But there are strong regional interests. So I'm saying that the fact that India has such a dysfunctional relationship with Bangladesh works very badly for Northeast India. So how do you begin this conversation to have a Northeast India focused foreign policy towards Bangladesh? That will certainly take very seriously the migration issue. You're right, at the moment that doesn't look like there's any interest, but you do. After all, diplomacy is about creating common interest, right? So I hope that's how I'm bearing.
Further questions?
Do we agree that the situation in Assam is replicated in most of the other states in the Northeast, or is Assam even within the Northeast sweeping areas?
A very good point. Yeah, this completely relates to the older regime. If you look at the, if you historically speaking, no, it's all right, I'll get to the map. Let's see. Look at my, in your handout, the map on page 3. That gives you all the states. So there are 7 states. Arunachal, Assam, Nagaland, Manipur, Meghalaya, Mizoram, Tripura. Of those 7 states in colonial times, Manipur and Tripura were native states, meaning they are princely states, kings. And of the other states, Assam was different. It was really more a normal law. I call it space of law, space of custom. So the idea was that in the tribal areas, custom prevailed. In the area, modern law can prevail. So many of these rights, which doesn't allow Indians to buy property, apply only to the spaces of custom. They don't apply to the spaces of law. So the biggest migration happens now to Assam and Tripura. Tripura was a native state. None of all those laws apply. So essentially, Tripura's population completely changes. Tripura became the first area for Hindu migrants. So now, if you look at Tripura's politics, essentially the entire population, majority are Bengali, right? But that happened because Tripura does not have any of those own laws. So Tripura probably is affected more than Assam in that sense. But you can't even say anymore is affected because it is very completely, the demography has changed completely. So after that, maybe Assam. And Manipur has the same problem, but because it has come into the regime later, and it is not as much part of the migration situation as yet. But Manipur doesn't have the same kind of protection. But it affects Assam the most with the important qualification of Tripura. Others, the old laws are interesting. Meghalaya, as I said, was not an excluded area, but it was a partially excluded area. But that little difference between partial and excluded makes a big difference. So after that, I would place Meghalaya as having the same problem. So there are places where, but there's a negative side about to it. Negative side is this. In Arunachal, you literally can have a vigilante action against Bangladesh. They can be expelled. Nobody will do anything. Assam, on the other hand, you can't do that because enough politicians will say, no, they're Indians. So things are worse in a sense. They don't have the same demographic challenge. Still, politically, Arunachal is the worst. You can simply, you know, round up people and say they're Bangladeshis, and nobody will do anything about it. In Assam, political balance, after all, the 30% of the population are Muslims. So as a result, enough politicians would intervene.
If I might ask a supplementary question.
Sure.
All the talk has been about immigrants from Bangladesh, but since the Northeast has a long common border with Burma, the economic situation there is worse than in Bangladesh. I, as an outsider, would think that people from Burma, sorry, Myanmar, would cross over the border and blend in, especially since they could blend in with the other ethnic groups.
Yeah, look, you're absolutely right. They actually, if you look at Mizoram, the southern state, Mizoram has a fairly significant Burmese Chin people. Mizos and Burmese are Chins. So that is the issue. Not the same kind of number. But if you ask me, apart from Bangladeshis and Chins, the biggest migration is by Indians. Right? So in a way, what I'm saying is that with all its problems, because Northeast India's open discourse has been more or less legal. They are simply saying that they're against Bangladesh because it is legally, they can say that. But the other side of it is legally, they're also accepting other Indians as okay. But number-wise, there's no reason to say that, you know, migrants from Bangladesh, from Bihar, UP are not as much. What's interesting, if you look at the separatist organizations, they're however saying that. So the United Liberation Front of Assam, they may not be significant in terms of political weight, but it's extremely interesting. They don't take the Bangladesh issue seriously because they're saying other migrants are as bad. So you have this very interesting situation where the legal definition, if you can stick to the legal definition, you manage the issue a little bit. But if you don't stick to the legal definition, then you make room for separatist organizations. Right? Because people really, so even the idea to say it's okay for other Indians to be there, it's not obvious that anybody would accept that. So as a result, you have an interesting dynamic between the legal definition of this issue and the paralegal definition of the issue. In the paralegal definition of the issue, even other Indian citizens become suspect.
So the irony of the situation is that, I'll give you the floor directly. The irony of the situation is that Arunachal Pradesh, where this vigilance action is going on, is actually claimed by China. And you can see on Chinese maps, Arunachal not being a part of India at all.
Yeah. Yeah, in fact, that's a very good point. There's one reason why India doesn't want to touch these laws. Because these laws also are really give people a sense that it's worth it to be part of India. So as a result, these exclusionary laws, they're not willing to risk huge political controversy in Arunachal about it because of that.
Guy, you have the floor.
I want to take the focus away from Assam, maybe to West Bengal, the other side of Bangladesh. How are the implications of this there? There's a communist government. You should think they're more inclusive or less nation-centered on citizenship. How do they treat their Bangladeshi immigrants? Is it a big issue?
You know, I would say by and large, those areas of South Asia that participated in the partition, Bengal would be the first one. So after all, half your population came from Bangladesh because they're Hindus. Your attitudes are very different. So I would say no matter what, Punjab and West Bengal. Punjab clearly was divided in the middle. Much of Punjab was in Pakistan. So, in fact, no Punjabi will take that Assamese view. One can say the biggest constituency of Hindu nationalism are Hindu refugees from Pakistan. If you look at almost many of the major leaders of Hindu nationalism, people like Advani, they all are Hindus from Pakistan. No way on earth they will take this discourse seriously, right? And Bengal is something like that. Huge numbers of Bengali Hindus, after all, came to Bengal as a result. Nobody thinks that Bengali Hindus should be there. So at the same time, I would say probably it's equally true that to the extent you have Hindu nationalism in Assam or Hindu nationalism in West Bengal, probably the Hindu partial migrant is more likely to be a Hindu nationalist. Right? But by and large, you don't see this politics in Bengal.
Is there no other questions? I'm going to say a few words, but it's also not such a bad idea, considering the state at which, the level at which your voice is going down. You don't want this important voice to go off altogether. But Professor Barwal is going to stay on in Heidelberg for a while. When do you leave? Sunday?
I think I leave on Sunday, yeah.
And he's staying at the guest house. The whole idea of the cluster was to make his visit not just a fly-by-night operation, but to give an opportunity to doctoral candidates, particularly those working on connected areas, as well as other professors from the cluster, to have an opportunity to interact with you. And so, if you have questions and you have not been able to ask them today, or you have decided not to ask them today, for reasons I will not go over again, there will be a second chance.
Give me my email address that I would be able to respond to and make sure that we meet Barwal at bar.edu.
Okay. The email address will be available with
so you can write me an email and then I can
then okay. Bring you into contact. In the absence of Shiva, I'm doing the interaction. Sanjeev, I will now say a few words as a cluster representative. I have a double role here. You know, the cluster is divided into four areas. Area A is our area. It's about governance and administration. And I'm the spokesperson for that area. We've got a number of other projects that our colleagues have not been able to come because we're all doing too many things all at the same time. The concept of the global political imaginary that you have mentioned, that you have referred to several times, we've talked about, it in a way connects all four areas and cross intersects. So the Excellence Project will go on for a number of years, and the first instance is going on for 5 years, and we'll have a chance to explore this idea even further, not only with specific reference to nation states, as we're doing here, but also visualization, heritage, and global communities. So there will be a chance to talk about it more. And as we do this, it would be nice also to think in terms of Asia-Asia comparison. I'd be interested personally in knowing how similar issues are discussed in other parts of South Asia. What we have heard today is very much an Indian discourse. How do the Sri Lankans talk about it? 1966, I think, the Shastri Cinema of that, or 65, it should be. So, they just decide, done. 2/3 of Sri Lankan Tamils on India, and there is no murmuring of protest within Sri Lanka about this hapless Tamils at a time. So they're paying for it now. So are there parallel discourses in South Asia about similar problems, and is there an opportunity to learn from one another? Because the Hindu nationalist argument has been that India is a soft landing pad. For anyone who has a problem, they just land it on India. Is that as simple as that? Or are other people also thinking about the dichotomous view of citizenship? Either you're a citizen or you're an alien, or are they moving towards what you have very imaginatively described as multilateral citizenship? Or are the facts on the ground begging for attention from political theories from which new concepts can come? Because that is what we want to harvest, we meaning the cluster, want to harvest from within, from the world of political action. The hand has gone up, the hand is the hand of cultural citizenship. Leonid, are you going to ask a question?
Well, not related to that particular field, but...
well, then you have my point to ask a question.
That would be a very short question, which I suppose is both a detriment to the state of the wars. Since we're talking about this European and Asian discourse and the outflows, so could it be possible, as we heard in the introduction, that Asia, and particularly India, has learned from Europe, and meanwhile the EU has moved on? So, and if I told you that in the EU, EU citizens are allowed to vote in municipal elections,
right,
if they reside in the country for a particular period of time, even though they're not citizens of that country,
right,
which certainly furthers the sense of belonging to that country in the first place, and to the European Union more generally. Would that be a model which would also work in South Asia?
Uh-huh. Well, I think I would certainly want to work towards a model like that, but a big difference now would be that the political instability is caused by the fact that there is no way of saying this person is from another country but is voting only at the local level, right? That's the South Asian contrast situation now. If you can say clearly this person is from Bangladesh but is voting in the Guwahati city election, then the problem wouldn't be what it is, right? So one will have to sort out that level as well before suggesting this is a solution, right? And to sort out that level, clearly the issue would be, can you sort out with some notion of universal citizenship, everybody should be a citizen, or can you sort out by at least reinforcing the idea that there is something called national citizenship? So my practical notion would be, you'd have to have that notion of national citizenship as well. Please answer my question. Yeah. Sorry, I hope my voice is better, and you're most welcome to talk to me next few days. I'll elaborate it further.
Yeah, thanks very much.
I would like Dr. Penn's speech is now to say a few words thanks to our visitors.
Such a pity that
you can stand up
also. Such a pity that this cough is cold, so to say. I was really looking forward to your visit because we met for the first time in last February in Delhi. At the fringes of the conference on the Northeast, and where similar questions were asked about identity and contested spaces, and afterwards we had a couple of beers and some peanut masala at the nice coffee house, common place, and we're exchanging a lot of ideas about citizenship. And I was telling you that this project was just about to start, this project on citizenship, so I was really looking forward to your visit here to Heidelberg, and I think you have not only, since you are not probably the authority from the political science perspective on the Northeast, but in this lecture you have not only depicted problems specific to the Northeast, you have delved more into a general citizenship issues and aspects which are of relevance for us to the classes, so I would like to extend thanks. Thank you to you, of course, as well. And I hope we have a lot of other individual interactions during the next couple of days. And thanks very much.
Thank you. Thanks.